I'm Eric Mill. I work at ACMS, which is a fairly new office in the federal government. I put an asterisk next to the word largest because after I submitted the title talk, I looked it up, and China is definitely a bigger government than the United States federal government. That was a little silly on my part, although the U.S. government is more federated and state and local governments are for more. But anyway, just moving on. There's an asterisk there. So I work for 18F, and they started to do a lot of things, and they sort of started to mean a lot of things to a lot of people. So we're at the U.S. General Services Administration, and our founding mission is to make government services better and to make sure that the government has the ability to do things in-house as they relate to technology. It means we want to help build things better. We want to help agencies buy things better. We want to design things better. We want to involve users. We want to do things in the open. We want to be transparent. We want to be agile. We want to do everything that we all think is nice and good. And we think that the U.S. government should be able to do those nice and good things as well. Before that, I joined ACMS 2 years ago. I was about 2 years old. And before that, I was a group called the Sunlight Foundation for about 5 years, which is a nonprofit, an NGO, and agency that focuses specifically on open government transparency, which is where I bought a fair amount of experience working on issues like the Freedom of Information Act, money in politics, open legislative data. And I've built a number of different services, but also sort of got a piece of policy work and politics and government. So I was invited here to talk about specifically the HTTPS executive policy that the White House Office of Management and Budget released for executive agencies last year. So I don't think this particular audience really needs to have HTTPS described to them. I'm kind of going to guess that you know how HTTPS works, at least at a high level. Even if you can get the websites and websites to be secure, there's a public impact. So I won't spend a lot of time on that. Most of the time, I'm going to focus on the government aspect of it, trying to shed a light on how the government relates to technology. So that policy that OMB published is very blunt, and it's very simple, it's very embedded. Any federal website and web service, APIs included, on the public internet should use a secure connection and use it by default. This is the actual text of that, and includes the CF mandate, and gives a deadline of December 31st, 2016. This is released in 2015, so about a year and a half. And it notes that it does not require HTTPS to be used on internet, it's focused on the public internet, so it does. I don't think I really need to explain what HTTPS says, but at least to demonstrate that we kind of know what we're talking about. This is from the policy of the White House Protection describing what HTTPS does, protects cookies, queries, things, URL paths, forms and machines, and it uses a protocol called TLS, and it relies on a series of publicly trusted certificate authorities to guarantee authenticity across the network. And what it doesn't do is it doesn't protect the IP addresses or domain names, and it doesn't protect the traffic. You can still get to it. You can still run that size of requested resources, and the information that's submitted, and see if it's time for an update. Obviously, there's some metadata that you can get on the internet, even though that's in place. And of course, it only guarantees the integrity of the connection, right? It doesn't actually guarantee that the web service is going to be hacked or compromised, and the user system is compromised, and they have. We can get fixed at all, or have some other form of compromise on it, but not in the world. And then finally, we also have an ETFTF, strict point for security requirement, which for the government is very vulnerable, which you'll see. But that actually includes, you can curl a whole bunch of different stuff like that. You can see that a lot of people have met for strict network policy, so they're not including Kilo Matter. So the basic outline of the talk here, we talk very briefly about working figure and to kind of shed a little bit of light on like actually working for the government, especially the place in GSA. Wanna talk a fair bit about how technology policy in the US government works and how people experience that. And I will go through sort of how we got to the point of creating the HTTPS policy that we did. And I'll talk about some products that we're making, some challenges that we found. Some are fairly unique to the federal government, others are sort of more prevalent there. And then I talked about key takeaways and all of that. I'm sure that that's taken up the time. So, it's really important to say, here's something about what I call you. I don't represent or work for the White House. I work for the U.S. General Services Administration, the most exciting agency in the federal government, General Services. We do buildings, they own all the buildings in the government, including all the courts and like the New York Trade Center. They own everything. They give themselves very nice buildings, they own everything. They do procurement and contracting, so they help agencies buy things, which they can use the government power of the government to negotiate government-wide deals, and then give other agencies benefit from that, and then GSA gets a bit of the cut. And that's a big part of its role and part of its funding. GSA is technology. GSA is in the cloud, right? So GSA is eventually using like cloud, email, documents, calendar. Written like you can have cloud servers deployed into like it's actually very nice. Not every agency has that. Some agencies get priority. They're the first agency to go to through the cloud in 2011, and they try to help other agencies do that too. They have the nice copy on the website about workplace balance, and they're really serious about that. I've worked on a project before, I've worked with private companies before, and I've worked with different companies before. And I've never had a more friendly and humane working environment than working for the U.S. government. In fact, it's the most friendly and remote work I've ever experienced. They deliberately don't even have any business right now. They actually, it's something that they build in, it's reflected in their IT strategy, why they're in the cloud, and they keep it spread all over the country and all over the world. They also, GSA as an agency, really good at open source. They support open source internally, they have tons and tons of things on various open source platforms like GitHub and other places. GSA is an agency prioritizing open source for the things that they need to run the internet and the financial support of the internet. And it's really expensive. So the White House separate policy effort, and they finalized it like 2 weeks ago. They have a different policy now. And during the public comment period for that, we each have a whole number of times trying to improve it a bit more of the open web quote. And you know, we've got comment actually from the CIO, our chief information officer. Most agencies are sort of the head of all kinds of technology. It's really emphasizing like, yeah, right. We totally agree that we are working for the agency. And also, something for this guy, I think you realize for a main enterprise password, we're still allowed to use strong accuracy. So we don't require to use uppercase characters and symbols and stuff. So it's the little things I think really define agency when it comes to this stuff. I don't know if anybody knows it, but next, actually, it's probably the last guy finally recognizing the first thing. So we don't rotate passwords all the time, and we don't mix the other ones. It's just kind of like that, but that's an action that is important right now. So, GSA Blue, GSA is a great place to work. It's a really good idea, but I'm spending some time on this because I'm kind of glad that working in the government actually doesn't have to be so bad. So in terms of the policy that I'm talking about here, the HWF policy in particular is published by a part of the White House called the Office. Well, technically, it's legislative names that is the Office of E-Government and Information Technology. They often go by Office of the Federal CIO, where the Federal Chief Information Officer works, Senator Tony Stack. And his office actually publishes IT policy, technology policy, that can be binding for federal agencies. And they are one of the few places in the government that can actually publish technology policy at a granular level when they choose, and they're not completely obsessed with national security at the time. It's a really good level. I've never worked there, I have a number of friends who have, and if you have a good chance to work there, I strongly recommend it. So, talk a little bit about the technology policy in the US government. It can be a very frightening thing, especially if you're used to sort of working in a non-regulated part of the private sector. So at the center of many things in the federal government is law called FISMA, which is the Federal Information Security Management Act, 2003. And it prescribes essentially this risk-based approach to information security and asks agencies as they go through their work setting up new systems to basically have you considered this all the things you make good checks, are you living in access control, are you scanning your system for vulnerabilities, that sort of thing. They play a major role in defining FISMA for federal agencies. They publish a whole number of DACs. One of the main DACs is special publication 853, which is a number that you can memorize really quickly in the organization's creating. And talks about the control that federal organizations have to take the information systems. And it is quite a long DAC. Hundreds of pages long, they talk about these controlled baselines at low, moderate, and high level, and good things in terms of confidentiality, integrity, and variability. There are controls, there are sub-controls, there are control families and groups, and it can be quite something to interpret if you're not used to have federal government talking about things and have federal government talking about things. And it has a lot of questions, many of which are quite relevant to federal work, different levels of sort of binding it formally and informally, but there's a lot of stuff that they do. You can see that in 2016, they've drafted that's 10.10. That's a great idea. So there's a ton of things. There's many publications. The White House, the Office of Management, and the Office of Management, generally, with those new things, not the technology policy, but the management of the budget, they publish new policies all throughout the year. So for 1 year, this is the first part of 1 year's worth of policy. You can kind of number them by the fiscal year and the number in order. So, like, M15 will want the first one of fiscal year 2015, and we keep going up. There's a lot of PDFs there. But the next 10 came out in fiscal year 2015. You see there's years and years worth of them. There's other bits on the 2016 that go back to the late 90s. And almost all of them are retracted. Like, very few of them have been retracted or replaced. Like, generally speaking, not all of the technology companies, but there's plenty of them. And some of the things are quite complicated. And which is that's the HGVS policy that comes sitting among the memoranda. So in addition to these memoranda, OMB also publishes documents called circulars, which are taken very seriously by people, even more seriously than one of them. And so, for example, one of them that OMB provides at 15 years, it finalized it 15 years ago, is circular A1000. Managing Federal Information as a Strategic Resource. It's 85 pages long, and it touches on, comes up, reinforces, specifies new things about all things information technology in the federal government. And then, of course, you have whatever agency you're doing, your agency will have a whole range of different policy for itself. And you will be expected to comply with things. To OAuth, to enterprise approval for software, to how computers are managed, to how laptops are provisioned, to how information is being handled, appropriate processes are done for that. So it is a lot. This is actually a recent policy that BSA published around OAuth 2.0, and it has really nice thing that internally developed scripts are implicitly allowed. Incentive approval for internally developed script, which is not something obvious to do, but the reason that it is a great place to work. And then, of course, more recently, something called FITARA, the Federal Information Technology Acquisition Reform Act. This is 2014 or 2015, fairly recent law. And it does a whole range of things, among them centralized and delegated authority in the Chief Information Officer of the agency. And so it calls the agency you need to have that meet some central management control and accountability. If Congress wants to call somebody for a hearing, talk with them, it can be very obvious to Congress who to talk to, who is responsible, and who to that team for the agency. This has led to lots and lots of supporting policy work. It's from some policy work at OMB about looking at FITARA. Even before agencies get around to reorganizing themselves and developing new policy and stuff, OMB has many things that they want to be doing to keep up on the law. So, altogether, I think all this stuff on the four traditional networks of overlapping requirements that is really impossible to keep in your head. This is a hypercube, and a hypercube, you can only experience four networks. sometimes looking into the left hand side of it, and from what angle you're looking at the type of thing, you will see a totally different 3D shape. And that different 3D shape is the only thing that any person is capable of holding in their head at the same time. It's exactly like IT calls in the federal government. Everybody can only handle that some unique snapshot that human beings can hold and place at once. And can't contain the entire thing. It is really difficult. And if you fail at all of that, right? And more specifically, like, if you screw up something, you know, and you weren't compliant with some of these policies, there are a number of oversight bodies that will make that fairly publicly known. Currently shared within the federal government, there are every single agency, which is called an officer and inspector density, that is meant to be a bank of agency really independent on, one that dual reports both to the head of the agency and also the Congress. They can all agree to the Congress in them seriously. They often operate entirely separate systems, so some of these are in the DNS, they'll be on their separate level domain, they'll have their email systems. To really try to operate separately and be this independent overseer in each state. And they do a lot of work. And then Congress also, in the legislative branch, things like the Government Accountability Office, which basically all day, every day, is releasing legislative reports from the government and the agencies. And they also do a ton of work and frequently find out what's going on with their agencies, try to make sure Congress is informed. And that is a whole government-wide body that works in the legislative branch. And of course, you can actually get directly overseen by the state itself or Congress generally. This is a recent hearing on the Senate. The U.S. Physical Service in the White House had an overseen hearing by the IT subcommittee of the House Oversight Committee. And it's a great hearing, and I recommend watching it. It's on YouTube. So, I found a question the other night, the first interview with the previous CTO of the Government Accountability Office, and he was being asked in an interview, how Sigma helped government IT security, and what I liked about the quote was to say, hey, security people need Sigma to get the job. Nothing is going to be done. It's really important. It's an advantage that people do not become complacent in effects on Fisma. If you don't need Fisma, you don't need all these documents. Like, none of them want to be a set of checkboxes. You know, they all talk about, like, it's important that I need to do due diligence, compliance, it's not security, etc. But if you have to go back and sum up, like, all of the things people are thinking as in terms of a multi-layered or intentional policy review, very difficult for people not to form checkboxes to get through the day. Because everybody only has one or two time resources. And it's a difficult situation. So, the whole data in my own head is that I think we have a lot of people talk about technical debt and manufacturing, people have technical policy debt in the federal government. People just add more things onto the pile, which I'm talking about being totally guilty of doing that, adding more onto the pile. We never really do factor, we never really for example, what the lawyers in the country have done with all the laws Congress passed, they take the laws that Congress passed, they break them up into sections, and they make them into a code. And that's kind of the only way that lawyers can actually do their job in the country, by having a new code that's organized by that word, and to correctly communicate Congress's laws that they pass. And you can literally go back and do all the text of all the bills, and kind of like order something. So, we all really do that in federal government, and so there's just a lot to do with. So one of the points to take from that is that it's not really enough just to like make a policy throw it on the pile. Those things happen all every week of the year. There's a new policy to deal with. So people actually have to care about it for it to get make the kind of change. And if you want a new policy, if you want it to really make some change, you have to care. And it will be your job to get some care, and nobody will do that for you, because everybody's way too busy, has other priorities, and they're really just trying to get their job done. They're trying to, like, make weather data happen, keep satellites out, keep the buildings running, provide valuable search services to people that need comments from people. And the government has a good job to do, and in case security, folks just kind of allow that to happen. So you have to take care enough to assert that. That's an important thing in our own lives and in the daily life. So I'll talk a little bit about how we actually got to the point of creating this, to give a little bit of a window. When we started ECMS in early 2014, one of the things that we were really proud of is that we had a blog, and the blog was, and still is, a group comfortable for technical subjects on a blog, with syntax highlighting, people want to use code samples, and those are the really big things that are very relevant in the federal government. Generally speaking, agency communications teams, they tend to focus on things of agency-wide importance and things that everybody in the agency like and things on at the executive level. Like there's a strong incentive that agencies have to stick to the high-level topics and stick to priorities of the agency. But we actually had a lot of we're talking about technical topics and sometimes talking about our opinions. In this case, we're talking about why we had an internal policy of using HTTPS encryption for every single service that we make. We do not perform a risk-based assessment to decide whether or not HTTPS is useful. We just do. And we do a whole bunch of rationale for that. And it's also important to understand this all happened around the same time as there were a bunch of new stories coming out about sort of how people were sort of discovering how the internet works. And not so much about any time stuff, but like all the various factors that exist out in the world, domestic and foreign, corporate and non-corporate. So this is around the time that people really draw attention to the fact that Verizon was encrypting tracking headers, encrypted traffic, which we actually managed to find Verizon for a couple of months ago for over $1 million. This is when people were noticing, wow, my IoT is encrypting ads into my day-to-day browser. That's very weird. And people in the media were starting to actually pay closer attention to things like this who might not, 2 years before or even a year before, actually taken the time out of their own busy day to write a story about what was essentially an invisible thing. In this case, this is a thing from the Washington Post, looking at that AIDS.gov was not using HTTPS on a service that allowed people to look up AIDS clinics by their location, which is who you want to. Not all kind of combined to create a big sense of momentum than really existed maybe 6 months before. So one of the things that we tried to do was we tried to make something that was really worth celebrating about and trying to get some energy and attention inside the federal government. So we spent a few months and basically went around and talked to people that we knew, reached out to agencies, wrote some code, scanned all the different .govs and see how far along people were. And to try to identify maybe people who would be more interested and receptive to kind of going out ahead on something. And we started reaching out and trying to collect a bunch of people, a bunch of .gov domains to fully tune those into Brad. So for those who don't kind of know how that works, Brad is sort of maintaining a big list of domains that they are building, And basically, when you do that, it means that the browser will enforce transport security for that domain before you go to visit it. The browser skips knowing that domain can be used to be its only indefinitely. So there were no .govs in the list at the end of 2014, early 2015. There were no parent .govs, second level domains. So wanted to see if we could get as many as possible and pop out of the code. You can actually see the 8-second email. It's one of the things that we're an unpleasant news story about location moving. They went out and not only fixed that, went through every single subdomain and owned it quite significant, and locked them all down, and then deleted their domain along with about 20 of them. That actually had a little bit of tech coverage. From the Post, I started to run the whole world of federal media out there, went on federal news radio, 8 a.m. radio at 6 in the morning for people driving around D.C. to get to work. There's local TV that focuses on government news for different people. Covered that was very interesting. And then also, a lot of other people, especially the agencies that started going at HTTPS by default. I actually don't have a slide for it, but in addition to the Federal Trade Commission, which, as many of you know, oversees privacy, in the U.S. generally, especially in the private sector, they moved that to that federal review of CBS by default and blogged about it, just, again, as I said, fairly unusual. The Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, which oversees the intelligence community and publishes deep analyses of like Section 702 and collections and 201 and the Patriot Act, they also moved their went over to CBS by default and co-wrote it. And then a little bit later, throughout the White House, until themselves, they created a new platform that came up with an impact they had at the time and put the bill on it. And so all that is just like, these things happening all the time really helped a lot. So by the time that came around, it actually was there had been an interview over the previous few months for OMB to propose a policy. And they actually they did a public commentary of the proposed policy, which, at the time, was the first time they've done this for because fundamentally, this isn't like a regulation. And it's also it's only on the revenue of trust, right? So there's not the same kind of, public mandate for them to do a public commentary and that sort of thing. It's just a different angle. And they started the state of gift policy, the very technical one. So this is really interesting. And they actually also came with an essay, which is a little unusual for OMB memorandum as well, to just kind of justify why it's taking such a blunt and broad approach. And so public comments here with email, but also the comments on GitHub. And there were a ton of comments from different groups, including some pull requests as well from people. And it was these comments were very important for legitimizing the effort, for making it, for increasing the momentum, for making it seem less radical, and also for giving constructive advice on how to improve the policy above all. And then a second here, Adrian felt also commented that they're looking forward to downloading the 2016 draft documents over to CBS, which Kinkley did confirm. That's nice. I also moved earlier this year. A couple of other things are happening on the time, too, which is that folks tracked the group name of China, but that was really something where whenever anybody did the intro of China, there are a whole number of different parts of the attack, and I bet people here can describe it more precisely than me. But one of the components of the attack was unencrypted requests to Baidu Analytics, which is a computer code to Google Analytics at the time. And for your regular people visiting websites that have nothing to do with Baidu, really, and nothing to do with, they don't even need to be about China. But those users visiting those analytics websites got weaponized by having their unencrypted traffic modified in flight to added JavaScript instruction that caused the browser to DOS and Google in order to take down some anti-sensitive material and firewalls. So that was a shockingly large-scale kind of frightening event for folks to pay attention to that. And then, from a government perspective, one of the interesting comments we got on the public comment process was from the ACLU, where they literally went through, so every inspector general, who I mentioned before, they all take whistleblower reports. And you can submit whistleblower reports in different ways. You can call them. You can send them an email. But a lot of them have a web form. And the ACLU actually went through and visited every IG web form, dug into a Chrome down inspector, and looked at the URL that the form posted to make sure there's something that happened in transit. And that first comment ID weren't actually encrypting whistleblower reports that they went across the public internet. Most of them got fixed real fast. That all contributed to, this is worth finalizing. And so the policy got finalized in June 2015. And we actually took a bunch of people's edits and determined that we could make a technical move and use the traffic that way. But we actually incorporated public comment into the climate policy. And so, after that, that's really kind of the beginning, because people then have to do a lot of work. And the topic is often going to be very new to people, and definitely going to bleed outside of, people's CIO shops, it's going to intrude on the lives of web managers, it's going to intrude on the lives of communication shops, it's going to intrude on the lives of various program offices. including lots of people in the APIs, data scientists. All these groups are something you have to pair. So there's many things that we've been doing since then to help people actually get this. So among them, we've done a few different hour-plus long, like an hour and 40 minutes, more than an hour-long thing, that were attended by hundreds of people across the various agencies in the federal government. Sometimes I walk through like why this is happening, what to do, how to deal with it in plain language, to be basic as possible, to try to reach a broader audience. We have this implementation site called hgf.gov that includes lots of detail on how to actually get this done, and things that are going to be relevant to people, figures of the work, your basics for transport security, things about like how to actually comply and deal with some federal specific issues, whether or not CRL and HTTP services are included. Like, it's all the little things that come up as people work with, as we work with agencies to try to get them to comply, all these questions will come up and try to answer them and actually get them back up onto the web and public authoritative place for other people. And answer a ton of questions about the certificate, because that is one of the biggest things agencies get hung up on and don't totally understand. Also, one related project that we can help about that, that I work on in particular, is to actually publish detailed like climate statistics about who is visiting the U.S. government. The U.S. government has a massive analytics testing program. People have been building about that, but they have SAP addresses and et cetera. But they basically pull together the different web analytics they get from many of their websites and try to provide actionable, useful data on interest of people. And this stuff is actually, like, a lot of the things that are much, it shows legacy climate patterns that are often much lower than agencies believe, because they sort of haven't met their assumptions in 5 years. And also, I think the web is, and computing in general, is getting better slowly at moving away from legacy climate, so the acceleration is increasing, that's the velocity. So that is really helpful, or the velocity is increasing, because that's the acceleration. So we also do a ton of in the groundwork, so we handle lots of support emails, try to walk people through recreations from Perl, and talk to us about lag reports, and we compare to different configurations and stuff. We actually travel to agencies physically to talk with the management staff and talking groups and address some questions that they have. And GSA in particular, a couple of shared services. So for any of you working on each of the application issues, there's a class of applications that have a real hard time doing it. The most work, they're taking the longest to move, but there's services where people see and custom their names over to them, right? So Tumblr and WordPress and GitHub are really good examples of that, where you have to generate a ton of certificates to manage their removal. You have to be able to prove that you own it, depending on how people point that stuff to you. So that takes quite a bit of work. And GSA actually operates a couple, about two services like that down the road for federated search and for WordPress service. So they have to do tons of work to implement automatic certificate provisioning. So that also affects the revision team and their domain. So we kind of work with them to help them get this done. But if you're going to do like more intangible stuff, for example, actually emit public celebrations of agencies when they do a good job. I know it's kind of basic stuff, but again, this is pretty rare inside the federal government for agencies to bother speaking about technical topics at all, and for them to really, to take the time and to pursue this. So we will try to do that, and reward folks when they do the job, so people have, sometimes tweets, sometimes other things, sometimes all that, people who can figure out and point to them. Also, one other little bit about there's a ton of support from Cambridge DHS called NCAS. This is the National Cybersecurity Assessment and Technical Services team. And they're part of DHS, part of that large agency. And they do a whole bunch of things. So they will do actual penetration testing, will do their team stuff. They will scan issues with vulnerability scanning, they'll use their own IP space and their own space, and just generally try to did technical systems for agencies on information security matters. They did a lot of work on Heartbleed and getting Heartbleed fixed inside the government, which I think kind of did a pretty good job of doing over time. So that's sort of what they do. They also some things a lot because they have done a ton of support on HTTPS in particular, and they really view it as an information security concern for users and for agencies. And really invest in it. They are also big on open source. They, in fact, even stuck their neck out a little bit on when the White House sent a public apology from public comment, actually contributed to that and said, you know, from an information security perspective, like, open source is good, more open source please. So I really want to call them out for being just a really strong beacon of support on implementing better PLS across the government. And not a tool actually that I was really familiar with before I joined the government, or even for my first year and a half in the government. And that's, you know, another thing that is important. So we also actually built a support gap, which is a different part of GSA that owns this. It's part of GSA called the Office of Government-Wide Policy. They actually own the .gov registry itself, the DNS registry. And they also have other related teams that work on best practices for the .gov space. So we work with them to build a dashboard that measures HTTPS. And actually try to measure, like, are you even enabled? Can you even use it at all? And it takes all the known .govs, all the known second level .govs rather, and measures are using HTTPS, are you enforcing it, and do you enforce security, and then also ties into the SSLF API and forwards that grade on. And this might sound conceptually simple, but it is very complicated to measure things along the way. Not only is the internet chaotic, but the government internet is very chaotic as well. So these are the first to create ever, but it is trying to measure compliance in a public way. Not public opinion, but public baseline of mine. So we'll talk a little bit about progress and challenges. So things are good and could be better. So this is showing a bit of measuring the backlog. This is from public. And it is also measuring the executive, legislative, and judicial branches. It's about, for the number at the bottom is wrong, it's about 1,300. No, it's about 1,150. It's over 1,000 government names, and it includes people who are using enforcement. So when the policy came out, it was at 2015-1, and now things have gone up a fair amount. And the things that heartened me about this are that. There's actually about hundreds of data that I've used. And even measuring the subdomain progress, which has also been quite substantial. So there are hundreds, possibly thousands of domains that have moved in time and that's been encrypted. One thing that's also interesting in this is that this network security was basically unbroken in the federal state starting in 2014. And the little bit that was there really came from the network I talked about earlier in early 2015. So this is very such a cool transport security. So that's a new concept to scale across in the federal space, and so there's more work to do. It's also worth understanding that if you actually look at like the internet at large, so this is a post from April, April 2015, and it basically did essentially the same thing, but looking in the electoral type 1 domain. And the numbers are quite low. The support rate overall is around 30%. Rejection is 5 or 10, depending on the measure. The transport is at 1.75%. So there's more to go here in government, but there's a lot to go everywhere. And one of the things that I know is also true is the deadline is later at the end of this year. That even the humans, and most of this has been happening in the last 3 months. So that's how my work in the talk happened the last few days, and it's going to go up. I know a number of agencies that have clear end of September deadlines and end of December deadlines, but they're all about going on. So we've got the product ready. There's a number of issues that make this really hard. So one thing is that nobody, not even the government or outside, has a complete list of .gov web services. And so you have a list of parent domains. That doesn't count all the subdomains, and they are legion. There are just many at least tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands in sort of that web services. We've done some work on that. We actually did work with the Docker registry to expand the available public list of parent domains, certain level domains. So that is a thing that we can use. And actually, turns out, another thing I can not understand, that there are way more state and local .govs than there are federal.govs. There's about 1,300 federal.gov domains, and about 5,300, I think 5,400 now, domains in total that include states, counties, cities, towns, power plants sometimes, like a lot of things. So that is a public data set now, and that's been very useful in a way that it wasn't there before. But honestly, like when you need to go and try to find all of the host names that might be web services, that's really available right now. I think looking at public data sets, so you can send it internally, census.io, to look at kind of a DMAP scan of the IPv4 space that it's taken every night. So we'll harvest host names from that. Take a look at the certificate transparency logs, which are an incredibly valuable resource. Not just for harvesting domain, but also just in general, has been transformative for PKI accountability on the website. And the existence of certificate transparency logs, and probably the existence of this year's CIFH website, particularly this project by CA, really led to a lot of people. And we use that extensively to try to figure out what is going on. Also, the analytics project I mentioned earlier actually does publish pretty comprehensive bulk data sets of host names found within the state. So that is also a very useful choice. None of these sources are complete. Data is incomplete everywhere. It looks terrible. But we, that's a challenge that we're working through. So I mentioned before that the transport is brand new for those things. And that's just because it's relatively new concept. The transport, it was proposed in 2009 or 2010, finalized a couple years after that. So this is generally kind of new. There's been really reasons that some of the things are difficult. So a lot of these things have tons of internet subdomains that are attached to the same kind of domains that have in public domains. That's a huge problem. So a lot of agencies are just not going to be able to preload their flagship domain and include all their subdomains for quite some time. It's one thing to go to all the public websites and websites, this is what they're listening to, that's what they're going to do it. But the internet ones are just an even bigger sprawl in some cases. And so that's the not going to work. In fact, some of these things have been undoed to the preload there, which annoys the Chrome team, but it's sometimes have to be done. And a further point, which is some of the shared services I mentioned earlier, where people will point their domains at them. Sometimes the shared services get certain level domains pointed at them, but the shared service isn't in control of the rest of the subdomain, so it can't automatically set the sort of policy on behalf of the customers. There are tons of malformed such transport headers, and they're sometimes logical to enter. Pager is watching a transport header count down in real time. I'm not showing the actual method, but if you kick that header for a while and curled it, it would be the transport header with a max age, and you curled it 2 seconds later, it would be lower, so it's counting down to zero, faster than 1 second. These things are fixed, but I can show that multiple times in a couple of different agencies. This is really fascinating. There's also the thing with the federal government, the federal government has its own EPA. They put into a ton of things, biggest among them are PIV cards, the ID cards that all the government employees carry. They all have certificates inside them, and they all came along in this big swirling federal PKI. And it's used all over the place, so there's a lot of confusion for London about agencies on months before, like, am I supposed to use the enterprise PKI for phrases of yes? And, sometimes you have to think yes if the audience drops the PKI. Right now, the government's enterprise PKI is not present in the Mozilla public sector. That's pretty tricky for people. So if you go to IAB, which is like the enterprise call sign, you may, depending on the platform you visit from, get data. And if they were to put strict transport as it is, then you would need to be able to click past the warning and get to the part where you can install the reproductive. If you have a number of .gov and .gov sites that actually have pages telling you how to download and install a root certificate so that you can come out to the website. And that is a really troubling problem that is is really unfortunately prevalent. People are looking at that, but it's a real effort. It's really not trivial for folks that they have to rewire a lot of stuff in terms of policy, their domain names. It's really not, you can't just change it on a dime. It's not just getting a ticket and putting it in place. There are really real operational changes that have to happen. This is basically the same way I just said, which is there's guidance and developments and the thing of how to deal with it, but it's basically, part of the point for security that people talk about less is the fact that you won't be able to put the security forms anymore. There's actually a profound impact on agency practices. So for federal PCI, just looking at directly, we're in this one all the time. So they are actually trying to get stuff to align with the browser forum. They expect to be publicly corrupted in 2019. That's a ways off. So, in general, people are kind of weird about doing this. And I'm not talking really so much about the enterprise PKI part, but it's part of it. But it is, there's not a ton of intuitive perception about the report, which is fine. I didn't know that it was important until a couple of years ago. I was building websites and didn't have to worry about it, so I didn't. That's kind of what people are. You learn what you have to do with your downtime. So that makes sense. But there's, this is part of the point of the feedback from the federal government. This is how to explain the difference between domain validation, organization validation, and extended validation. And the method of it is really trying to bring the agency. Sometimes they call it that really expensive, domain validating certificate, which measures the control over the DNS domain, and don't validate your business paperwork or your paperwork, are completely acceptable for government use. There's nothing cryptographically weaker about those things, but the point of the HTTPS is really about securing the connection and not the entity. And you can assume that the government is not only about their domain name. That not everybody can register one of it. So if you prove you're only about their domain name, you've actually already proven who you are also. So there's really could be no barrier to using them for a government. But a lot of folks don't sort of think through the fact that in an attack situation, the certificate that you put in place, the certificate that you bought, that you paid for, that you put that work into, it's a signed certificate that has all of your information on it, during an attack, that certificate is nowhere to be found, from a user's perspective. And the person being attacked has no vantage point to see what you're doing. So, you may still, eyes wide open, choose to get the certificate you want. Whether it's a name validated or otherwise. But you should be doing that, but you should understand what the actual security value of the sentiment. And there's not a ton of intuitive understanding in the government of that. Similarly, a lot of agencies really like making whitelists of approved certificate authorities, stepping on top of sort of how the town forum and how the different resource programs operate. But basically, the same exact idea. If you're looking at the policy alone and not using something that's public key pen, you're not really protecting yourself because you can have your employees pull from only the most secure PA that the government ran and personally accepted and approved. But if an attacker gets distributed in any of your publicly trusted PAs, and that's what they're attacking the users with, your certificate isn't doing anything. You have to actually use technical measures if you're doing any selection like that. And that's important in other ways to think. So talking through that approach is a challenge. So enterprise inspection, in a corporate man in the middle, is still a thing. Not all agencies do it, believe it or not, but many do. And many men in the future, many men in the south, I know. It's not consistent, but it's very present. And something that has come up, I probably have the same opinion that many of you do on home mailboxes, and to reduce the security surface that your network has and that your users have, between competing with security surfaces that private term offer. But it's very hard to answer people when they say, what do we do instead? Certainly, there are many companies that have lots of engineers, and they can do more sophisticated work with NetFlow data. Maybe you can start worrying about application level logs and trying to centralize those things. Format or something, like a lot of different ways of trying to come up with the same thing. But there's really not a simple story at all. And many of the stories that do come up require a very high level of resources and expertise that tends not to exist in and most everybody generally, including them. So one of my favorite takeaways from that is that you need more people to talk more about what they do instead of enterprise man in the middle. And you actually need a lot more software, open source software, to really not vendor products. That point a positive vision that's a different way forward than corporate man in the middle. Because there's so many things in the middle. It is very simple, very understandable, and it gives I think that's what they want. So if you want to do something different than it is, I think I want that from the government perspective, I think everybody wants that from the perspective of the larger internet, then we need to have a clear story of how to do. So I want to point that some of the particularly great hard work. There's a project called API.data.gov that hosts APIs on the service inside the government. So they've done a really incredible job handling the API transition. So, migrating an API that has non-graphic clients to insecure security can be really serious endeavor. You can't just flip a redirect and be done. You don't have clients will behave. And so, they take a number of different approaches. They can do options of how to turn this stuff around, including making it so that people with new API keys would only be able to use HTTPS and prevent a container problem, and they can have a variety of different transition mechanisms. And this is the sort of thing I am into APIs in the private sector really embracing this sort of thing and trying clear migration processes like that. But similarly, it was very recent. The NIH has an API around biomedical information. And then, if you look at it, you can very well see it. And it has really detailed migration advice for people. And they've gone on GitHub and they've found a whole bunch of client libraries and they're working with the community to patch them. That's real work. Similarly, I mentioned earlier that the federated search engine that GitHub has is going to automatically deploy new certificates for people. Same for the WordPress that we serve project called So one thing also is that Norway is looking at doing an HTTPS policy and deciding they want to do one. They have two different agencies. They have their DoD equivalent and they have their sort of DHS NSA equivalent. Both say this should be done. And the NSM which I think is the DHS NSA equivalent, has done a detailed report analyzing why this should be done and coming up with a clear rationale. After motivated by a Norwegian journalist programmer who worked at Pulse, the US passport that we did, and set one up on for the newspaper that we worked for. This story, showed how far Norway had to go, and that's been more motivating the platform, which is very helpful. So to kind of wrap stuff up here and get into the Q&A, so some takeaways from this. From a broader internet perspective, for explaining the internet stuff, there really is so much left to go in terms of getting rid of plain text traffic on the web. One thing that really struck me recently in April, so President Obama went on American Idol, and it was an hour of American Idol, and he wanted Americans to vote. Really great Democratic message, and he said, go to vote.gov, register today. And vote.gov had just been set up a few weeks before. The landing page are basically direct people to their templates, voting forms and stuff. Great. And everybody who obeyed that message, who followed that, and went to vote.gov, and said vote.gov, and was interested. If they're going to transport security, then that's not going to be enough. Nobody's ever done it before. They walked on the website that day, and not an engagement. And it's also not viable that you're always going to have 90 days ahead of time to pre-order your name and then wait for it to go out through four different browsers release levels. So it's really not a viable way for somebody like the president or some other large scale kind of announcement like that to seize the moment, tell people to go to a website, and have that be done securely. And maybe there's been an MITM, the security director, the vote.gov. That we just have to deal with that. The principle is really important. We really need to get to the point, the only way we're dealing with that is to get to the point where you actually are preloading the exception to secure connections. Long ago, but we have to be making really a tangible commitment that feels uncomfortable at the time to get there. I would really like freeload.gov just in the top but like also it's there. I mentioned before there's like 4,000 other.gov domains that are state, local, travel. It's a massive network. This is for a very tiny PLD, 5,300 domains. We've got to find things to do, right? So for example, you could be pushing top level domain operators, including all the new generic domain operators. It requires to be able to go forward for new registered domains. And in fact, the domain operator could enforce that by two other new stuff. Like, if they have a technical enforcement matter, it doesn't have to be a policy outcome. Right? And maybe that's not appropriate for 100.0 PLDs, but it's probably appropriate for almost all of them. And these are things that we can do to try to reduce the surface area of attack for the web. And this became really apparent to me in the last year. So on the government side, just kind of going back to the government topic, it's sort of what I started, the technical policy debt that exists in the U.S. government, we need to pay it down, and I don't know exactly how it's going to happen, but there are a bunch of things that we really need to focus on. So the government should be willing to retract outdated policies when they become outdated. That is very hard for people sometimes, both politically and practically, and who's got the time. But that's something that we have to account for, and that's the political space for. I think we literally have to refactor the multi-layered set of policies that we have, which do the equivalent of what the U.S. code is for the law, and actually try to make sense of what do I, in my job, have to worry about day-to-day, so that I don't get me and my agency in trouble. We also need to be posting internal policies and practices publicly. So agencies need to share how they operate, which agencies don't like sharing that, and they really need to, not just because of the general principle of the public space now, but because that's actually what's going to bring the outside perspective in, and the agencies that need to have that perspective and how they operate, and the agencies that operate really well, and the kind of examples that you want to set right into, that's how you do it. You publicize what you do, you make them public so that people in the agencies, no matter who the job is, can see that work and be influenced by it and take it and make it operational instead of managing it. That is a really vital thing that is consistently underappreciated. And when internal policies are needed, part of the time it takes to solicit public comment is to basically to bring that outside perspective in, to legitimize the work that's being done, and to make that work more impactful, so we can really engage the public on how agencies operate. It's a matter of public interest, and there's also just a lot more subject matter experts outside that can be helpful and consistently find time. And then, also, when working policy, that we need to focus on making compliance costs proportionate to the risk. Okay, so, compliance is a big thing in any regulated industry, and it's very relevant in the government. And it's within compliance. I was showing a dashboard measuring each DSE. That's a compliance measure. Compliance is a real thing, it's very useful. But the cost of compliance can always be proportionate to the benefit that you get and the risk that you get. And that generally that gets disconnected very quickly, especially in a government where the people making the policies are often very separate from people implementing them and the people having to actually use them. Something that I think is really important is to have a positive focus in your daily life. Right? So people don't love being shamed. I mean, that stuff happens, right? But and occasionally it's necessary. That's part of the way that life works. You really need to do that as a failure to. Like, something has gone wrong. If the only way to fix your system is to either be a hearing or a press story about it. That means you look a fool, and then also changes the politics internally in your agency to oppress future work because of giant perceived risk increase. That's not good, right? You don't get what you want out of putting people in the court. Well, it causes a lot of problems when you do that. And fundamentally, people in the government are humans and want to be part of something great. And you'll get a much better sort of long-term collaborative relationship with them if you make them feel part of something great, because they are part of something great, and everybody can contribute. And when you're rewarding that and you're celebrating people who do a good job, when you're pointing out how like something that they did made a meaningful contribution to the whole, you can get a really good response from people, especially really huge bureaucracy. And the larger the bureaucracy, you kind of better because you have a higher chance of finding people who have the time and interest. And sort of one of the general strategies I found of working in bureaucracy is to multitask everything all the time. Like, don't wait on other people to solve something for you. And you have to put a lot of irons in the fire. Some will work and some won't, but the things that work will end up leading to more things, and you just kind of continue that practice. And I mentioned before that agencies really need to talk about their technical work in a positive way. It should be when they do something good, when they're really happy with what they've done, they can talk about it. Very difficult for agencies to do, but very necessary. And for folks working out there that want to see better technology policy in the U.S. government, the advice is fairly basic. Your comments really matter. You really have to show up. I don't just mean the public comment period that I showed earlier, but also I mean like formal regulatory public comments. Like a public and fellow answer, their notices of proposed rulemaking, the FTC is going to do this thing, the FTC is going to do this thing, EPA is going to do this thing. Comments really matter. More than I think people in the technical community realize, having gone to a tech school and being in a tech industry seems to be this thread of apathy or form for, kind of the way that people talk themselves out of voting, but then it doesn't matter. People talk themselves out of doing work commenting and participating in public discourse like that. But I have to say, I don't know that folks realize that the U.S. government, when there's a regulation published, the agency is legally bound and always does respond to every unique constructive comment they get. You can go look through the coverage and you can see tons of examples of new things you propose to comment. The agency saying, this person had a good point, we need to change, and move on with it. They go through that stuff. And then, from my perspective, having been out of a couple of public comment processes, a lot of people sort of think of the agency as the voice of the agency's communication team. In reality, or the agency's head, the news stories, the way the agency's carrying the news. And you don't always imagine the subject matter experts that are kind of 2 days back, but your comments get right to them. Those are the only people who even have a proper to comment, and they're going to, and they're going to do the work to create space for that agency and company. You have to put them, and you don't always will, and they may not have the same opinions and interests as you. So you really can do that. And as you do that work, and as you go about your public life, you really need to think outside of the community of practice. The information security community in particular is pretty large. We don't want to be larger, but it's large. It's enough that you could spend maybe your whole career like talking within the information security community and being good success that way. The more that you kind of stretch yourself and spend time communicating what you're talking about and its importance for people outside of your community, then the more impactful you're going to be on policy, on law, on just generally how society tends to lead itself. There's a lot of people out there, a lot of decision makers and executives and celebrity executives and so forth, who are intellectually curious, but they're not subject matter experts. Fundamentally, when you do this, if you're empowering people on the inside to win arguments that they already wanted to win and they just needed some legitimacy from the inside. So, you can learn from the inside and work for the government. I love working for the government, and you may or may not know that the Federal Trade Commission recently opened an Office of Technology Research and Investigation. They employ often people who get into, they're probably reading, all the papers in the conference. And they are trying to determine and make it actionable. I would be shocked if there weren't some folks here tonight. I know I've worked there before. It's the U.S. Digital Service that is based out of the White House, and they employ technology to do all sorts of White House and presidential priorities and to join teams from different large and small agencies and make a difference. I mentioned GSA. I really like working for GSA. I can recommend not working for GNAS, but I think GSA that. That we make public service operate better, more consistently, and clearly, and we also have working in different services. So that's the end of my talk. I'm really happy to take some questions and answers, and thank you very much for having me.
If you have questions, could you please make your way to the center microphone and remember to do it during the meeting
question. I'm Jeremy, I'm signed with DARPA. And I actually answered a great question for DARPA. I previously included NFL, also a great question to serve as to your country, helping collect and fund the best research out there in the Navy and the public funds that way, or where we were to. So I have two questions. One, I'm not like the great things that work in German. One, I'll say, not so much on some of the stuff. So in order to do my job, I have to go to various DoD sites who would require not only accepting certificates of data knows what order them, but also running Java apps in order to use my top card, which is the equivalent of the DoD fifth card. So my first question is, are you addressing some of these other things like need to run Java as part of this, as long as you're cleaning things up and clean that up? And my second question is that I was meeting with a colleague on the Hill recently, and she told me that this was a committee staff, and she told me that they tried to update the committee site to HTTPS. And they couldn't because they were dependent on some other hashtag kind of site where all the videos of the hearings were found, and those weren't updated. But those folks weren't updating their site because the committee sites hadn't been updated. And so there was sort of this, we'll do it when you do it, and nothing is happening. And so I'm wondering if you've had any experience in breaking those sorts of logjams.
Yeah, so that is. Yes, those all been come up a lot. So actually, any government contract in particular is not really government specific, but is cancer upon trying to transition what they can be secure. And it can be a problem. I know that the Senate has a video platform to kind of include that. There's a simple answer, but a lot of these things tend to work themselves out kind of once you achieve critical threshold of people who have a reason to care and have a reason to work on it. So you don't get everybody to do it, but you have to get enough that people start to feel in the minority for not doing it. There's one difficult thing, and you wrote a little bit of branch example, and Boston Contact and executive branch example, and it's no clear what good branch whatsoever. But a lot of the stuff if you want the legislative branch and the judicial branch to transition to stuff, you have to communicate through what will happen if they don't, like what's the penalty, and you said that to people. And then, yeah, as you uncover some of the issues, one thing that I'll do, and John has done it before, is actually work with folks to try to measure it. Like, what is the level of lengthy filing that you're doing? Actually, from the table instead of moving this thing over. Generally speaking, people weren't making it previously, so that's the first step. And a lot of the times that is either lower than they expected, or at least it points them in a direction that they know how to start working on. So again, to see from point A to point B before, they would just be like, well, but we have all these problems. And so now we're spending electrical energy to figure out the solution that because it's part of breaking it down in a 2 minute term problem for that to be able to work. So I think a key function that myself and others who are trying to work on the thing can do for people is to break down the term problem for them and give them clear point A, point B. So with DoD and FPK certificates, there's never really need to do for that, but we can work with people to try to identify, maybe they measured it this way. Maybe you can consider a measure that people don't have three people get installed, you can observe impact. There's not a simple answer to your question, but the answer is yes, and it just you have to actually get in the defense of people and have them work through the problem.
Thank you.
I'm Robert Anstrom, University of Washington. I like your job. It's also a challenge.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fine. I think I heard something, and I'd like you to repeat it and perhaps extend the link. I think you said that this Mozilla product, probably Firefox, for which you do not load the preload, the root PA for a popular government CA, and therefore you can't, you can't force people over when they search from that CA. Mozilla started out not too far from the United States, and it seems like we can kind of call them up and say, hey, can you please preload our CA reader?
I mean, they pop all the time, and some of that's public and some of that's not. But the main issue with the PCI enterprise PCI government is that they aren't coming with the same requirements and guidelines that are applicable to publicly trusted to get your card. So even though it happens in the case and on the bill is really kind of not, generally speaking, the PCI browser forum will decide on the baseline requirements that CPA is expected to adhere to get accepted. Mozilla is more strict about that. But other new programs have to use the CPA, so they don't make it better, but nonetheless in the new program. It's worth understanding that it's not really a scenario of, well, if they've talked it out and fine, there's real operational things that an enterprise PPI and the federal PPI in particular have to make in order to comply. There are examples of that around, monitoring influence of public DNS things and how you handle the DNS extensions and policy voids and stuff. And it's actual work they have to do. So the best guidance that folks that we can really give in the first position is that it's probably can't use a federal government PA to secure your website. You should be able to prove that that's the appropriate PA to use by using transcript security, which will mean that people who don't have that group can't even click through it all. So they can't click through the certificate line, and we can never be asking people to click through the certificate lines for any reason, because that is an indistinguishable potential attack. And to the extent it causes problems, then those are problems that already existed, and they're now being made very clear to people, but they were never not there, they were just under the table.
You said you're not expecting internet home now. Can you see the government PPI is going to be as common as the process for browsers written by Safari and Chrome and those folks? And could Mozilla be allowed now in the harmonization?
No, you can't do that. For one, Mozilla is neutral used by more than just five clients. So that is used by Android as well, used on whatever Linux server that's out there. Used by basically whenever somebody isn't, Microsoft or Apple, then you need a root store, you reach them in the world. And they're also the only root store that operates totally publicly. So all requests are public, debates about it are public, the public has a chance to review and provide and to comment. Whereas the daily root store is basically, and ultimately, the description of root store really matters, but there's no accountability or visibility in the application journey. So it may be an uncomfortable situation from the ability to feel it, but really the goal is just the most direct representation of the standards that we have for the WPCI today.
Yeah, thank you. Hi, I'm Mike Forrester, and Mike really is interested in Jetson. So the kind of organizational structure of the federal government is available via that USAID.gov API. I thought that was really nice.
It wasn't really clear enough to go to that site.
Just kind of compiled relationships, so it's kind of in a way. My real question is, have you guys thought about signing with every agency and organization to give anyone who consumes that data a way to refer to an organization?
So the question our folks are, should we work on a reasonable organizational part for the government? Do we need to identify a first part?
Yeah, so
while I'm not familiar with the current mechanics, that is actually something that The White House has this thing called the National Action Plan. They've done a few of them now in the administration, and they're not going to do more of them. The last one included a commitment to develop a reasonable organizational chart. And that's been a subject of interest in the outside open government compliance community, of which I come from, for a long time. Not a simple thing, so government is really complicated. But yeah, so I don't know exactly what the state of that is or how the time I'm using the commitment, but at least that is something that folks care about and are kind of working on. And if you'd like, I'm happy to afterwards to give it to folks and I'd work on that.
Yeah, there we go. Second question is including the website, the identity and authentication, and the main project that we have. I was wondering about
you talked about a lot of the benefits of working for NASA or JPL, but what specifically made you decide to go work for the
program? So, I don't totally know, so I've been working in my foundation for 5 years, and I actually came in to that a little bit working with, I worked for a few months into the 2009 campaign, and then I joined the Commonwealth Foundation in 2009, and ended up spending a lot of my time working with Congress, like working with House Republicans and legislative branch, and as well as many Democrats there, and really broadened my perspective quite a bit on federal government and public service, and made me focus a lot on how the incentive structure of the federal government is often more important than the people that are contained in it. So, having an independent legislature is definitely not unique in the world, but it's actually pretty common. I sort of continue to focus more on the civil service aspect of the government than its political leadership. And when I was looking at APM, so looking at DSA, it quickly became apparent to me, as when folks were starting with APM, both the people that were forming the original, the early team and what the stated goals were, it seemed to align really clearly with values around openness and values of putting users first and taking a broader perspective on government than just kind of getting the political demands of the moment done. So my read on what GSA had offered in that regard was very important to me. And so I was kind of surprised to go into the government instead of staying in the advocacy sector, but
that would be the right call. How do you like to do it? So, the government is one big thing, but obviously, it's a more important part of the fact that only information also, even if the video detail is not something really important, do you have like levels or kind of justification of size that will enforce
different tools to different types of stuff? So, from the perspective of monitoring PLS in government now, and partly that's because the policy is very deliberately saying do it all the time, stop calculating whether the risk is enough or not. The risk is enough, always do it. There is the way the government's information security regime is structured is off risk level, so everything gets categorized low, medium, and high, just generally, and then also with specific regard to confidentiality, integrity, and availability. And there's different controls and different policies are applied at different levels. And that doesn't mean to do that sort of thing. But in this particular case, this policy is actually kind of to cut through that and say that the particular control is relevant to everything.
Patrick Bryant, Rotarians Research. What do agencies do about Missouri's non support of the federal common policy?
Yeah. Sure. Well, then you can, the most important element would be for the agency, especially if you just get heavy in the federal PCAP and you have your own MTA that is related to the federal PCAP, would be to work. The federal PCAP has like, really specific plans of how to address that. You can contact them and work very closely with them to accelerate and vandalize with the other agencies that, you know, that the picture, the way they're acting like. Like really be an active participant in getting the government enterprise PKI to a place where it can non-controversially become part of the PKI.
That's probably going to be not there.
Well, that's a number for them, and do you have to talk with them about moving that number forward or back and how to help do that, right? But that's fundamentally the work we have to start with NASA and with every agency that participates. The word PKI is not flawless, but certificate transparency logs have shown all sorts of ways in which the word PKI has been falling down, it's still falling down, where there's ways in which it's connected that people didn't anticipate. Sometimes PKIs are all like that too, right? Like, it's very difficult for everybody to be separate. And so I think the word PKI is going through a big cleanup period now. Everybody that runs an enterprise PCAP in the world should be going to the same PCAP and taking the same lessons that a lot of PAs define such a thing from the PCAP.
Would you consider a workaround where users are engaged to download the common policy group in a roundabout way as being advisable?
I personally do think that is inadvisable. That's most of it. I don't think you can train people to download certificates and throw them. And I think it's very difficult to offer that kind of advice in a way that everybody can handle it. Our users can download the certificate, run fast practice online or something like that to verify it. There is no way I'm aware of, nor do any of the government instructions I see contemplate having anybody do that sort of thing.
Security. So thank you for your talk. It was really, really good. I just had a quick question. So reaching and enabling HTTPS is kind of half the battle, right? Because it's a moving target, best practices, configurations. Does a policy kind of address the challenges of where things are going to be 3-4 years down the line as new vulnerabilities are introduced and cyber things are updated?
So yes and no, in a deliberate manner. So if you look at the policy, see that it talks about challenges and iterations, and then it mentions about things, talks about planning for things. It doesn't have to be, a authoritative piece of philosophy for federal agencies to constantly be working with this stuff. And they should be looking at government and public resources about it. There's also some material that you can hear about in the most common examples, right? I don't think the government really wants to get anything like that. I don't think they're doing this in the business of having to maintain constantly up-to-date best practices. But there are various places that are going to do that, it helps them to plan for things all the time. And when things come up with really common issues, we've got to help people do that and pulse the flight, some of that stuff. But policy explicitly is not like people in the PR 1.2. It's something about commit to a secure connection, and that's the level at which it's approaching the problem.
Yeah. The only reason I have to know is that on your website you have the SSLX API server for all the domains. Is there some kind of a threshold where you say, look, if you have an app, there's an issue,
that's kind of why you have it up there, right? To provide. And when when Pulse launched, it had a bunch of battles, and it got thrown away very quickly. And there's still some there, but like, a lot of them got fixed, and I do get emails a fair amount from people talking about the grade and how to improve it. So it is right now somewhat passive. So you know, you can certainly imagine ways in which you can start creating feeds of that stuff and proactively notify people. But right now it's pretty good.
Thank you again.
Mm-hmm.